I'm Har Kumar, co-founder and CEO at Novator.
The world of construction is constantly evolving with a whole host of new technologies that are changing the way the industry operates. But as generally happens, the bachelor's in architecture degree remains rooted in the past, with most students not really coming out equipped with the necessary skills to operate the new age tools used by the industry. Har Kumar Singh was himself a student of architecture when he saw the problem and decided to build an edtech startup to solve this problem. His venture, Novator, is a global leader in the architectural education space, equipping students with skills to use the cutting-edge tools in architecture, thereby enabling them to earn much better salaries. And most importantly, they are building Novator as a sustainable business and are on the way to hit an ARR of $40 million on just $1 million of funding. Stay tuned for an insightful conversation on building a sustainable edtech business.
So, HK, as your friends and people who know you call you, give me an elevator pitch of Novator.
At Novator, we are building online cohort-based courses for architects, engineers, and designers so that they can advance in their professional growth.
Let's unpack it a little bit. So, cohort-based is as opposed to self-based. So, cohort-based means that there will be a bunch of 50 or 100 or certain number of students who start a batch together. It's going to be like the way we have batches in offline world, similar to that, except it's online.
Yes, yes, totally. So, cohort is to do with, a specific start time, a specific end time, and that creates a controlled environment where learners are supposed to do work, get it done. You know, it helps in closing for the procrastination usually we do while learning on a self-paced program. And it also creates a space where a more synchronous learning can happen, where people can interact with each other live. There is a common time we work together to learn. So that's the advantage of doing a cohort-based learning.
Right. The learning from peers is probably more valuable than anything else, at least from what I remember during my B-school days. What are the courses that you offer?
So we currently offer courses in two specific technologies, I would say. One is BIM, Building Information Modeling, and the other is Computational Design. And we offer these programs for architects, civil engineers, and we do enroll mechanical and electrical engineers as well. However, we are coming up with a purely focused program on that category as well.
Help me understand what is, you are in the space of construction then, broadly speaking. What goes on when a building is getting constructed? What are the different parts of it? Because you spoke of BIM and computational design. To an outsider, they seem exactly the same. What is the difference?
Got it. So let's pick up, when any building or infrastructure, when I say infrastructure, assume things like highways, roads, bridges, some sort of urban scale development. All this is part of infrastructure and buildings as a also part of it. So when we look at any development that happens, it goes through high level four phases, and there are more technical complexities to it, but I'll break it down into four broad phases, which everyone can understand. Any development starts with survey, like you survey the site, the land where something has to be built, soil condition, et cetera, et cetera. And apart from that, straight away, we get into the next phase, which is about designing and scoping out what has to be built, how exactly the entire design is going to be put together, and also breaking that down into how execution of construction is going to take place. So there is a term called GFC we create by the end of it, good for construction, drawings as a set. And then it moves into the phase of, construction, where on-site building construction actually happens, whether we are, whatever the project is onto, there's an entire phase of how the construction is going to take place. And it's not limited to what's happening just in that particular, site. It hampers, some sort of a context as well. If suppose a metro station is going to be built, it's going to hamper a lot of other parts of the day-to-day movement of people. So even traffic engineers get involved, and many other things are a part of how construction is going to take place. And then eventually, once the construction is completed and things come together, we move on to the fourth phase, which is operating and running an infrastructure. So, you know, evaluating energy consumption, water consumption, all parts of it, and how day-to-day running is happening for the infrastructure build. So these are the broad level four phases of a construction process.
Where does BIM and computational design fit into this?
All right. So talking about BIM and computation, let's just narrow down. You know, I discussed just four phases. BIM and computation are the new technologies which, you know, talk about digitalization of things within the certain parts of the process. But let's go back a bit, like how they used to actually happen. When we used to look at surveying for decades, surveying has always happened through things like total stations, or, you know, like doing a lot of hands-on ground work to survey the topography of a land. And you see, right, like suddenly this has evolved. Surveying has entirely evolved into things like GIS, geographical, you know, information systems, or GPS, you know, how we map geography overall. Or there are, you know, more new technologies that have come in. Apart from that, as you move further into design process, if we are talking about some sort of complex design that has to be come together, which is more efficient, optimized, more sustainable, you know, usually we used to put in a lot of hours, man hours, into doing a lot of analysis, evaluating data, and probably it would take months and years. And in today's date, with computation, you can feed in algorithms and data and come up with simulations of design that, you know, the form can be more optimized like this, or the building's orientation, or the form can be optimized to create, you know, make sure it has more daylight or lesser energy consumption due to sun, et cetera, et cetera. Or probably, you know, structural analysis as well, that in this seismic zone with, you know, this sort of intensity of earthquakes happening in the zone, this is how it was more structurally stable. And that all analysis, which would initially take probably months, can now be broken down into days and hours actually. And you can come up with a lot of simulations, compare them, and say, this is how it should be done. Similarly, in the entire execution phase...
What is this called, this simulation?
This is all under the subset of using computation to come up with designs. Now, okay. Sustainability, or, you know, like, for example, the cars you see in today's day, the fluidic designs, they are optimized for, you know, dynamism with respect to air and wind. And how you optimize that form, it's a lot of computation that goes into it. Or probably, you know, the shoes that in today's day Nike or Adidas produces, how can add to the movement of humans? It's all led by computational design. So it's from buildings to a shoe to a furniture, everything it can be used to optimize. And
okay, understood. So computational design is doing a like a digital twin of the building within which is interacting with the environment so that the design can be optimized based on how it responds and reacts to the environment and the other factors in it. And okay.
Yeah. So there is more to digital twin. I'll probably get back to that once I pick up the subject of BIM with you. So to put you together, like look at the construction phase. We usually, traditionally, we would have paper drawings. We would, you know, organize things through a lot of coordination over organizing Excels, et cetera, or over phone calls, video calls, what's happening. We would put together those paper drawings and take it to site. Before I narrow down, let me also get a step back. Let's look at a big building. A 10-story building has to be built. You know, on an average, a typical building has close to 20 different specialized consultants working on that building to make that come to life. There is someone looking at, you know, electrical, someone looking at, you know, obviously it starts with architecture, moves into civil, structure engineering, electrical, mechanical engineer comes in to look at heat, ventilation, air conditioning of the building. There is someone who's coming in as a fire, you know, technician, someone who's coming in for various reasons. And when 20 of these have to collaborate on a project, it makes it very, very difficult for all of them to make sure everything is coming together well. And what happens? They all break down things on certain base drawings or base work that has been done. But when actually the building starts coming together, there is so much of conflict that, okay, you know, we have put together water pipes over here, but the duct for the wind has to come over here. So like air has to come over here. So how do we narrow this down? And suddenly there is so much of breakage and then assembling it and time that goes along with it. That's what makes the construction process very tedious. Now with adoption of BIM, this entire process is becoming digital. You basically, when you design something, you have made a digital model. That model is extracted into information. So BIM is about, you know, information, data, and information management. So everything is as a data point, whether it's measurements, whether it's textures, whether it's color, whatever specification you put in, it's all a data point. And you start making a digital twin of that building that you're going to construct. And all these consultants that I just mentioned, 20 of them, they start collaborating on that digital model to make that thing very, very clean, you know, resolved, and everything in place. And to give you an idea, as soon as a digital twin is infused, and you know, we start putting in something called clash detection. How many clashes does a building has when everyone's work is, you know, put together on a model? It comes with 2,000, 3,000 clashes. And that's where, you know, AI is being integrated. And then suddenly you keep resolving. You take a few weeks, a few months to resolve all clashes and then start construction or move into that part of the construction. And it eventually leads to you saving years on that entire construction execution. And that's what the process of this is. And BIM and digital twin is not limited to construction process alone. It also plays a very pivotal role in operating and maintaining the building in a much efficient and better manner, because everything is now data and information.
Okay. Understood. Interesting. If I was to compare it with building a mobile app, so the UI UX design, what a product manager does, you know, the flows, the UI UX design would be computational design, and what probably the tech team does in terms of the microservices and the APIs and the integrations and the whole backend architecture is what happens in the BIM phase.
So product managers are responsible for the relevant output, but it's product designers who get involved in the UI, UX and intuitive experience of the product entirely. So architects and designers are the ones who are looking at the computational design front of that. All sorts of engineers are looking at BIM, etc., and all those parts. And imagine a product manager similar to, in the construction industry, someone who's a construction manager or a project manager. And they are the ones who are coordinating from design to delivery to all the parts in between to make the desired outcome come to life.
So the BIM is primarily run by the project manager.
Yeah, so there are project managers who are eyeing how everything is organized and various engineers working onto it, having an understanding of BIM and their specialized skill to integrate everything in that.
Okay, understood. Now, you know, there are different levels of learning a skill. If I was to make a career in finance, I could go and do a course in Tally, which would teach me basics of accounting and how to use Tally for bookkeeping. Or I could do a CA or I could do a CFA. And you know, I mean, the value add is correspondingly higher. Where would a BIM course fall in this hierarchy or a computational design course fall in this hierarchy?
So a typical program that we have put together does cover close to 15 to 20 softwares, but the core focus is on workflows. How, you know, as a computational designer, you would be evolving from a design that you have put together to a BIM workflow end to end and actually be a part of the entire chain of the things. And similarly, we have identified some of the top companies of the world which are into construction, infrastructure, architectural design, all these. We identified, like, you know, there are these unique workflows that they have put together that makes the entire process so much better and faster. And those workflows have been integrated as the part of the curriculum and the course. And we have close to 21 of them as part of the course. And that basically makes you really capable to go out there and be of value to any organization where you will be.
Give me an example of what a workflow would be like.
A workflow would be something, you know, so there is a scope or a design concept that we are putting together. Now, we have narrowed it down that, you know, this is the design, final design, what we want. Now, the process is we scope it out a brief.
that it needs to have these many building, rooms of meeting rooms, these many conference rooms, these many workstations, et cetera, and that evaluates, like comes out as a design. Now, design, apart from functional needs, has to solve for a lot of different things. How the energy analysis is happening, how much energy consumption is happening for the building, how much, you know, building would heat up because of the design we have put together. So from that design, which is functional, to evolving into something that's more sustainably sound design. And then going through the same circle that it solves for the function to and fro a bit better. And when once, you know, through the cycles that has been solved, that has to be extended to an entire BIM workflow. So usually we do a lot of computational design in softwares like Rhino. We plug in something called Grasshopper. So we put together a workflow of how I can write algorithms and how I can put together data structures through which designs can come out. And then once that's done, that's extended to a software called Revit. So once we move a parametric design to Revit, Revit is where BIM starts happening, where, you know, everyone starts collaborating on the project to put layers of it that, yeah, you know, the ducting of the entire building would look like this. The electrical conduiting of entire building would look like this. And that's how layer after layer, everything starts coming together. So these are, this is a, you know, how you transition from one part to the other is a way, you know, workflows happen internally within the organizations for processes. There are organizations who don't do modeling, complex computational modeling on, you know, Rhino straight away. They at times use softwares like Maya, which lead to a very intense fluidic modeling, like how fluidic forms are designed. And that's something in architecture we call blobitecture. So how fluidic forms are designed and then extended to computation and then move to Revit. So there are various ways in which the entire process works.
Okay. You're not just teaching them tools, as you said. You know, the bigger value add you're doing is teaching them how those tools get used in companies. So how did you crack that part of it?
All right. So I come from a family of architects. Okay. As a kid, I was exposed to this entire space of construction. It was fascinating seeing, you know, ideas becoming sketches, sketches becoming drawings, drawings becoming buildings. And very early, I was clear I want to be an architect someday. And eventually, when I pursued architecture, for me, while I was going through the five-year course, two, three things I evaluated, and they stood out very interestingly for me. I'll just put one of the things together. I realized most of my learning came together from the ones teaching me who were practicing out there, and they knew how exactly things happen. Probably not from the professors who come from a lot of research background and knowledge, and they have an understanding of the subject truly, but practical understanding of things really helped me figure out, like, you know, what truly works. And that became one of the founding DNA of this, you know, that when we build Novator, we will ensure that almost 80% of curriculum is designed by faculty or designed by people who are practicing out there in some of the top companies in the world. And they are the one contributing to the curriculum design. They are the one contributing to the structure of module after module, the capstone projects that we put together, the complexity of those. And then that extends with, you know, the guides we have on the platform who are also practicing for 5 to 6 years. So the ones who create curriculum are all the ones who have at least 20, 25 years of experience in the industry. And then we have industry guides who have 5 to 7 years experience in the industry. They all come together to run the show at Novator and create the curriculum, everything coming together well.
Continuing that thread, you were passionate about being an architect. What changed?
Okay. So when I graduated like 5-6 years back, and I really felt that education had a big gap in terms of what the industry was wanting us to know and learn and what we truly had an understanding of. And all the people I met, you know, who were practicing, running firms, running studios, running companies, they said, the simple reason is that people are not equipped with relevant skills enough, and that's what creates the gap. And for me, the thought was, okay, you know, if this is a problem, why isn't someone solving this problem? And when we got deep enough, we realized, forget it, let's get on and solve it ourselves. And that's how inception happened for us, that let's figure out, like, what are the missing parts. And it's immense. I'll give you, I came across 3 years back in 2021, a report by United Nations. it talked about that the way, you know, urbanization is happening globally, the way population is growing, and the way, you know, the living patterns of humans are evolving, the amount of construction that is going to take place in the next 3 decades is going to be equivalent to the amount of construction that has happened in the last 2 centuries. And that blew me away. And similarly, like, we saw that the education for this particular domain of AEC, architecture, engineering, and construction, wasn't doing justice to what the industry was wanting the individuals to learn, whether in early career or mid-career. And we said, let's get on, let's figure out what's the best way to solve it. And we were able to get the initial set of, you know, like, obviously the first 1,000 students were taught by me and Vipanchi. We got involved with students, we were hands-on, we were on foot. This is just before COVID when we were teaching. And then that evolved to getting the first set of 10 mentors, the next set of 20 mentors to teach. And as of today, we have close to like 400 mentors who are teaching on our platform.
You didn't sit for placements at the end of, you did it from SPA, right? Your architecture course?
Yeah.
You didn't sit for placements?
So architecture schools never have placements. That wasn't the thing. Architects always would start their boutique practices. But ours was the first batch which started placements in the college. And it was one of my co-founders, Chaitanya, who started and set up the entire placement cell in the SPA. And that still continues. So that's where we started realizing the ecosystem is becoming more structured. The ecosystem is moving in a certain direction that is leading to a certain space. And that's how it came together.
When did you teach your first set of students?
So I started teaching maths when I was 14 years old. So I started teaching maths to 11 and 12 year old kids. So one of my teachers used to take tuitions and he called me and said, why don't you teach these students maths? And I said, okay, I'll come. And that's how I got into teaching. I taught maths. Then in college, I started teaching building construction to a set of students. And then apart from that, I was also very enthusiastic about real world, you know, modeling, like architectural models. So I started teaching batch after batch how to make good architectural models, and that evolved into eventually teaching as a core thing.
Where were you getting the students from? Like these were your juniors in college or?
Yeah. Juniors from college, juniors from my school who were pursuing architecture as well. So, you know, we are from this entire generation of Instagram. So back in 2014-15, I used to post my architectural models a lot. That, you know, I made this today. And people would reach out to me that, you know, can I work with you? Can you help me, you know, figure this out? I started getting some freelance projects to make a model for this, that. I made an entire city model of Varanasi probably 6 years back. It has like all 80 hearts, the entire city mapped out and then made into a topography model.
Wow. Amazing. And this education that you were doing along with college, was it lucrative financially?
So architects early in their careers are not paid really well. They have to put across because it's an analysis we did. If you see, all high-paying jobs are the ones where digital penetration is very, very high. And impact from your work can be relatively higher. So if you're really good at that skill, whether you know how to code or you're a good UI UX designer, or you can do certain things, you will be paid really well. However, architecture, civil engineering, all these fields doesn't create that space. But for the ones who are able to go through that initial 8-10 years of a lot of hard work, are able to create a lot of value for themselves eventually. So it's a bit, I would say, staggered or, you know, a delayed, but eventually it kicks in to create a very lucrative career. My dad had an architectural practice. So, you know, I saw that how it came together. When we initially used to teach back in college, etc., it was pure out of passion and excitement to be able to put across what we have learned and figured out to, you know, more people. However, as we moved out, we realized like, you know, this has to evolve into a business. If, you know, eventually we see more mentors getting involved and we have to take care of their salaries. We have to take care of how the logistics of delivering a program come together. This has to be priced. So for me, my co-founders, there has been a journey of learning on the internet that how pricing structures work, why it should be priced at a certain manner. And eventually it was a journey that, yeah, let's put together pricing to a program. Let's see if students are willing to pay. If yes, how much are they willing to pay? And how exactly the balance between our economics of business and the value we create for a learner comes together. And they are all put together and, you know, eventually come together as a company innovator.
When COVID hit, what kind of pricing were you at by that time? And what kind of course duration? And
yeah, so there has been a journey. We used to teach people offline, okay? And it used to be two-day, three-day long boot camp where we would be in Delhi, Bombay, Bangalore, teaching a bunch of 40, 50 students together for a couple of weekend or a weekend boot camp. And then COVID happened. Till that time, I have no idea about there is a thing called EdTech. Okay. And this is the first time I learned something is called EdTech. And this is like probably June of or April, May of 2020, 1 or 2 months into COVID. And we started learning about EdTech. What are MOOCs, massive open online courses? What are, you know, what have been the different phases of EdTech in the last 15 years, 20 years? And we did a lot of trial and error, a 500 rupee, you know, short content consumption or webinar sort of a structure where we engage people or probably let's
this
try.
Trial and error was forced on you because of the world going online, because offline education kind of stopped. What were you earning monthly by that time through the offline?
So we as founders, so we were 8-9 people team. We as founders were withdrawing no salary. We were just making sure we make 3-4 lakhs a month so that we can pay those 3-4 people those salaries, pay, you know, the running cost of the office and make things end-to-end come together. We used to work out of garage at Vipanchi's place. Our dad had a garage 30 years back. It was a storeroom. We moved it into an office and that's where we used to operate out of.
And what was the vision at that stage? Like pre-going online when you were, you know, doing this through offline courses and all. Like what did you think you could become in a couple of years?
It was a very interesting thought. Okay. Our model was we used to tie up with SPAs, NIDs, NIFTs, and different architecture, design, engineering colleges. We used to ask them if they would give a couple of classrooms for a boot camp for a few days over the weekend during the week. And it used to be a barter. In return, the students of there can be part of the program that we are teaching. Okay, we won't pay them. And that's how the entire model was working. And at that time, our vision was, can this evolve into an OYO of education? Okay, it was a very real estate focused, you know, thing.
That okay, interesting.
Private institutions have a lot of classrooms vacant free. And can the access, etc., and community system can be built where random people come together, learn, make friends, network with each other, move out, and learn more. And we realized when we used to do those 3-4-day boot camps, 5-10 people enrolled in our, like people used to enroll back-to-back programs every next weekend, whatever the case is. And we saw that retention coming together. But we realized it's not the best scalable model as of today. We were iterating, we were figuring it out. We wanted to make it learning fest sort of a scenario. It's summer of 2020. We would do like 15 boot camps together in a college during the summer. And different people will come together and learn and create pavilions and installations because that's what design, architecture, engineering in that space is all about. Then post-COVID, I think next 10 months, not post-COVID, like when exactly COVID happened in the country, 10, 12 months were one of the very hard phase for us as a very, you know, a team, small team trying to figure out things. We had next to negligible revenue. We were trying to figure out things. We had a few savings. We tried to put together things, whatever it is through that. And there was probably like a day when, you know, we had to pay 3-3.5 lakh salaries a week later to the team. And we had 1 lakh rupees in the company's bank account. And I remember like me getting up that morning, going to my co-founder saying like, what do we do? How do we handle this? And so like, yeah, we'll figure it out. Let's figure out like if we can put something together that can generate revenue and in next 10, 12, 15 days and make the ends meet. But we persisted. I think we launched ourselves close to 5 times during those 9 months with a newer product every time, every 1.5 months. There was a time we also
take me through what were those 5 launches like?
There were a series of things we did what we used to do as weekend boot camps. We kept, that as an online product, like a 4 or 5 hour long program for a day, a 2 day Saturday, Sunday program, enroll in it, learn from these faculty. And it was more also like a marketplace model. Then we also moved into MOOCs. We did free programs through which, recorded content can be consumed. But we realized it's already a thing of the past. What are we trying to do? Almost 5,000 people had enrolled in that program as well. It was like priced at like probably 1,500, 2,000 rupees. But it didn't make sense as a business model. We couldn't provide enough value to the users where we wanted it to be. We started realizing job, career growth, true upskilling, through working on projects is the essence. And post that, that clarity came out. And it was actually, we had decided probably we won't be able to do it. So let it be. We go on a holiday. We are in Goa in a coffee shop. And we say, let's give it one more shot after going back to Delhi. And we got back. We put things together for 2 months, 3 months. And that's how, 3 years back, we relaunched ourselves. And things started falling in place.
That was your first cohort-based, purely online course that you launched?
Yeah. We launched it in April or May 2021.
And how did you sell it?
Online, like purely digital marketing, a lot of content marketing. I think education, people need to understand, like, especially look at it, the segment we are tying. Like, we are building for people who are going to take decisions for themselves. They are mature enough to understand their particular field already to a certain extent. They understand the gaps. So they have to know enough about where the industry is headed. They need to know enough about how things are happening, where different government initiatives are going, et cetera, and what these technologies are all about and what the future looks like. So a lot of content through social medias or YouTube, it all had to be fed, and we started engaging and enrolling learners on our platform.
You probably didn't have money for paid advertising and
first cohort we didn't have, but
it was purely that, just like hustling, creating content, becoming like mini influencers to get enrollments.
So that luck at an individual level, but we try to make Novator as the influential space where you get to know about where the industry is headed and what all is happening.
So your name was One is Stocks earlier, right?
Yes.
Yeah. When did the name change happen and why did you change?
Okay. So this happened 10 months back in May last year, 9 months back, actually. One is 2X was a dining table conversation as a name where we wanted to teach people how to make architectural models. Okay. So that is how we started. So when we were teaching people how to make architectural models, architecture models are usually built at a scale, 1:1, 1:5, 1:50, 1:100. Okay. And we said, let's put it 1:x and bought a domain 1:x, and 1:x became a thing. However,
and this was when you launched your first cohort course, or even before that you had one?
Even before, when we used to teach offline. Okay. Like this is like 2019.
Okay.
And then suddenly we realized this only resonates with architectural audience. We want to, take up the entire AEC industry, talk to the entire AEC industry. Also,
AEC
the vision
is,
architecture, engineering, and construction industry.
Okay.
Yeah. And not just that, we want to also, be about education linked to research and innovation. And when we talked about innovation a lot, it came to us that, innovator comes together very well as a thing. And from that, the name came Novator.
So coming back, that first cohort, which did it like save you as a business? Like, did you earn enough to pay salaries? And you had pretty much decided in Goa that this is our one last shot, one last attempt. So then what happened when you ran the first cohort?
So, we narrowed down on actually 3 things in Goa. We realized we are 3 architects trying to build a tech company. We know what we want to do, but we won't be able to do it if we don't have a co-founding teammate who doesn't have tech in their DNA. So we need that. We also felt like last 1 year has been a lot of hand-to-mouth, end-to-end, just very hard struggle. we probably need to raise some capital to, you know, have better leeway of things, like how they can pan out. And lastly, the entire focus on cohort-based program on the topic of Rhino and Grasshopper to be taught to the architects in the best possible manner. And this is how it will be brought together. And we came back. We started gaining that momentum that people started enrolling in that program. People were very excited about the proposition. It was priced at like a 30,000 rupees per seat.
Okay.
It was a three and a half month long program. Hmm. And
how many did you enroll in batch one?
I think it was some 25 students, 27 students. Hmm.
Okay.
Yeah. So it like, and it happened over a period of 6 weeks. So we had an upfront, you know, sort of 10 odd lakhs coming together through that, 9 lakh, 10 lakh. Yeah. And we could put together, but two more things happened. I met Mehul. Mehul was working at Cult Fit, you know, Cure Fit building backend systems over there. He got pretty excited about what we are building. He came on board as a co-founder. At that same time, we were applying for Y Combinator. We got through YC, got that initial check through YC. And then, you know, it was entirely about let's build it and make it happen.
The YC pitch was for this only, like creating courses for AEC.
Yeah, cohort-based courses for AEC. Exactly
okay.
That.
Okay. Understood. Amazing. And like, tell me just like, you know, broad through numbers, like how it grew year on year. Like the first cohort gave you about 10 lakhs. What did you end that year at? And how has that grown? Just to understand the scale and how that has been happening.
Yeah. So post that, in 2021, when the first cohort kicked off, we said we need focused environment to build and focus how the go-to-market for this product is going to look like. So four of us decided that let's book an Airbnb in the outskirts of the city, move into that for 6 months, and just focus on building and figuring out what go-to-market is going to look like. We were a team of 7 people. One of our teammates was remote. 6 of us moved into the apartment. It was a 4 BHK. We had a full-time help who would cook food, organize things. And all we did was ideate, put together the learning experience. There was a lot of effort that went into, you know, again, we don't come from education background. So understanding what instructional design is all about, how people consume instructions, how people learn, what makes learning engaging, what gamification of learning can do and how it can be adopted. There was a lot of research that went during that phase to understand those parts, put together a better, more robust program around BIM, which with the first version of BIM program in September, October of 2021, and started getting first set of international mentors to be on our platform and teach with us. And that's how the circle started kicking in. By the end of it, we raised our first round of funding. A lot of interesting.
How much did you raise?
We raised $1.2 million at that time. And, you know, we connected with a lot of interesting angels. They got pretty excited about the space where we are operating, what we're trying to do, how we are trying to change, what are unique things in learning that we are trying to solve for. And that's how the round came together with a couple of VCs also coming on board. And as soon as that happened, last 2 years, 2022, 2023, it has been about a lot of focused, you know, aggressive growth. We wanted to make sure that we are growing in the right way, in the right manner. And we grew in 2022 at an average of 25% month on month. And 2023 was an average growth of 14 to 15% month on month. And because the market slowed down, EdTech slowed down in 23, there is a, you know, perception and everything, but like we are pretty focused how we want to bring it together. And we're pretty clear about how, not just this, like this reality also check further came together that in EdTech, education comes first. And you have to solve for education very, very well in the right manner and keep the learner at the center. Everyone is a unique learner. Everyone is a different learner. How does that get together for a learner on our end has been the biggest problem statement since day one. And we are focused in working on that.
Okay. What will you close this year at? What do you project? current year's revenue? What will be your ARR? Or...
probably like a 40, 45 million annualized revenue.
Wow, amazing. 45 million ARR with just a 1.2 million fundraise. That is phenomenal capital efficiency.
Let's see. Fingers crossed. Team is on it. We are working hard to, you know, make that happen. But I truly believe business is an outcome. You just set the parts of it, projections of it, where we want to be. It's a product that does justice to it. That product keeps showing that why it's one of the best programs out there in the world.
I want to understand how you've been so capital efficient. I'm yet to come across a similar ratio of like 1 million raise to hit 40 million ARR kind of a... and you've not hit that yet, but you're on track to hit it. It may happen in 3 months or 6 months is what I'm assuming. But how did it happen? What's the secret sauce?
So...
is it that the business is very profitable, high margin business, or you don't have competition yet, or, you know, what like from a big picture perspective, what would a VC give me as an answer if I was to ask him how Novartis did this?
So see, 2 years, 3 years back when we were trying a lot of things, right, it came together as a simple formula for me that I put together has to work out really well. Your unit economics of business, your key value proposition, and your perceived value have to come together really well with each other. And then only a good business model can be established. I really think education as a space is somewhere where you can't be like that, let me get the users and the volume first and we'll make money eventually. This will never work out. You have to figure out how your delivery cost is going to come together with so many people working towards making a learner capable, how your customer acquisition, your marketing spends, your entire machine of growth is going to consume, you know, capital. And then how you are allocating capital towards your product, your learning vertical, your engineering side of the business to create, keep creating product that's leading the market, that's making sure you're one of the best products in the market that nobody else has put together. So that has been the thought process and the team has worked on that in the last 2.5-3 years. That is the focus also going forward from here in the next 3-4 years, that how do we make sure that the product is winning for us because rest all falls in place.
What help me understand the margin profile of this business. Like what do you, for a cohort of, what is a cohort size on an average?
So we work on a cohort size of, it varies like for different programs. Certain programs have cohorts of 50 to 60 people as well. Certain programs have cohort sizes of 250, 300 people as well. And the thought is that we are able to...
100 cohort program, what does it cost you to run that program? What is the marketing spend on that? And what would be the other cost of delivery and maybe some overhead allocation and stuff like that?
Yeah, so... you know, so the main cost throughout is the manpower cost, like the spends on mentors, spends on internal teaching a team, the spends across that. We do spend close to 25% to deliver a cohort of 100 students. And
how much would a cohort of 100 earn you? What's an average ticket price of a course?
So it depends, but a typical cohort of 100 would probably make anything between 1.5 to 2 CR.
Okay.
And you would spend like 40, 50-ish on the entire delivery of the unit. And then the thought is...
And how much for the customer acquisition cost?
So overall, it would be close to another, I would say 25% added to it.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah.
So the remaining 25% is your margin. About 25 to 35% is for covering overheads plus margin.
Yes. So that's like basically our EBITDA is at around 20% as of today. The intent is to keep scaling at that EBITDA of 15-20% with a growth rate of 10-15% month on month, and figure out where we face challenges, where we have to rework our strategies, where we have to stitch the dots better.
So you are, you no longer need to raise funds, right? If you have an EBITDA of 20% and growing at 10%. And
if we want to like stay in what we have figured, probably no. But there is an intent to expand business further with new geographies being the focus areas, not remaining, you know, to the domestic zone entirely. And apart from that, you know, offerings with respect to how there are team upskillings that are required and needed. So these are like things we have
like
ideated.
Corporate B2B businesses.
Yeah. Not just corporates, even colleges. Like on both the fronts, there is a lot of requirement, you know, with national education policy giving leeway to schools also having 30% of their curriculum or 20% of their curriculum being, you know, from a third party provider. That's where the demand also exists. So we are evaluating what's the right way to approach. Let's see.
Okay. So currently, like major part of your revenue is India based, or what's the split like?
Yeah, major part is India based. Like almost like 80-90% of our revenue comes from India.
And I guess you've kept your overheads pretty low, right? I think only 5% of it is about overheads based on what we were.
Yeah, probably 8-10%. But yeah, that's about it.
Okay. Understood. So what is special about Novator? Is it that this space has less competition and you're one of the few players in the AEC space? Or is it that there are other players also, but you have a significantly better product offering? You know, what is special about Novator?
Okay, so we started building Novator on one principle. There is a thumb rule of learning called the 10, 20 and 70% rule. Okay, so now if you look at traditional education, it entirely follows this particular rule. What it says is 10% of learning for anyone happens when someone tells you, this is what the concept is, this is what this particular theorem is, this is how this happens, and this is how it's applied to a problem. 20% of the learning happens when you, you know, discuss that same thing with your peers, see them applying on, you know, different problem statements in a unique manner, figuring it out what they have done differently, or ideating or telling them what you have done uniquely about it. And 70% of the learning happens when you do projects yourself, when you try it out yourself. Suppose someone taught me, you know, this is what basic proportionality theorem is all about. And this is what, like, that's 10%. It will be, you know, it will be in my head. But till the time I don't apply it enough, I don't figure it out where all it can be used in different manner through various applications and discuss it with my peers and get some social validation also about it, doesn't lead to a space where you have learned it completely. And we said, let's create a space where we can satisfy all three. How peer-to-peer learning and social interaction and social learning can take place. How project-based learning is facilitated very, very well. Now, just to pick that up further. Project-based learning, you know, you try and solve problems, but you will be stuck. You will have issues like, you know, you won't be able to solve problems. Over there, a faster feedback loop becomes very important. How fast you get, this is where you're going wrong. This is where you can do it better. And that's why query resolution or feedback loop becomes a very quite essential part of how learning is built. And these are the scoped areas where we figured out that very important parts of making quality learning happening and people actually becoming capable by the end of it when they're learning on the platform. And because of that, as of today, almost 300 students have got placed through Novator. And they all have got an average hike of 107% on their previous salaries. And in general, even for the freshers as well, to give you like some quick numbers, a typical civil engineer architect, you know, starts their career at a salary as low, like that's actually an average salary, around 2-2.5 lakh CTC. A typical fresher out of Novator gets an average salary of 5-5.5 lakhs. And that's where they pick their career straight away. And that sort of starts becoming one of the differentiators, but we have learners, like I certainly believe, if you come in, I want a job and that's why I want to learn, you won't be able to make the best out of it. Learning has to be, you know, from very intrinsic motivation, that this is very interesting, I want to learn it and I want to probably become the best at it. All those are outputs and they automatically happen.
Amazing. How many students have you covered lifetime? Like number of students who have gone through the courses?
So till date, close to 4,000 students have enrolled in our program. While we speak, a number around 3,000 is still learning and almost like 800, 900 of them have graduated and gone out to, you know, do various things in their life.
Okay. And the reason for this is the course is long?
A typical course is like 8-9 months long.
Okay. And is it like a full day, full-time course equal to college? Or is it like a part-time you do along with college, along with job?
Yeah. No, it's part-time. You have to probably like, if you want to do the bare minimum, you have to make at least 10 to 12 hours a week. If you want to do good, make 15, 16 hours a week. If you want to thrive, put in 20, 25 hours a week and you will probably stand out really well with the program.
Amazing. How do you solve for motivation? Because I'm missing the key difference, you know, what you also said, if you only come for money, it may not work. You need to be intrinsically motivated to learn. So is it that at the time of, do you have some sort of a selection process before you enroll people to screen for motivation, or do you try and build motivation during the course, or, you know, how do you solve that motivation challenge?
So obviously initial screening is one of the critical criteria that you get people who are motivated internally, have an intent, have the right intent, not the wrong intent. And people with right intent usually ask the right questions during admission counseling. They are, you know, talking about right things. And we have some structures where we evaluate learners, they fill in applications. They talk to our admission counselor as well, where they, you know, talk about what are their expectations. And over there, we try to scrutinize that we are getting the right set of people together. Now, what happens is when you have...
What is the right ratio then of people who want to pay versus people whom you admit? Like, so how many people do you reject where you feel that, no, there is a motivation problem?
So out of the, like, obviously from the motivation angle itself, we almost reject like 60 to 70% people. But from the overall people who apply for the program and our team, almost 3% people end up being a part of the program. Okay. 3.5%.
Okay. Because some of them may be window shopping and so on.
Yeah.
Out of this, people with serious intent, 40% of them get enrolled.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. And this call to reject is the counselor's call, or how does that happen?
Yeah. We have certain benchmarkings in place. And over there itself, at times, like, you know, when you try and apply, it asks you for certain intent. And there is automated mail also that will go to a learner that this is what we won't be able to cover. And this is what we actually provide. And if not, you probably can look at, you know, some other space where this can be fulfilled, but not with us. So that's what the overall conversation is like. And yeah, that's about it.
Do you feel bad about the fact that you're leaving 60% of the revenue on the table? In a way, you're only capitalizing on 40% of your revenue potential.
So I would say from a business perspective, I would say, yeah. But at the end of the day, if you look at from business perspective at all, you know, properly, in the long run, this is what is going to build a great university or a great space to learn at eventually. And that's what the goal is. I truly believe focus on the quality, keep focusing on the quality, create one of the best products out there. It will, like, you know, help you play the long-term game really, really well. And that's what we are on to. We didn't start the company because we wanted to build a edtech business. We started the company because we felt a gap. We resonated with it. And we felt, look, you know, my entire batch is facing it. You know, our senior batches are facing it. This has to be solved in the best possible manner. So we really want to solve this problem really, really well. I'll probably share, you know, some more interesting data points with you. Our technical education, you know, there's something called school to college enrollment ratio. In our country, this entire enrollment ratio stands at 27%, whereas in the West, it is between 60 to 80%. So there is a dearth of, in general, quality education for higher education infrastructure. And that too, it's further, you know, needs amplification in technical education alone. And in that you have IT sector, construction sector, and manufacturing sector where most of the technical education graduates move into. So our intent is to create that facilitation where rightly equipped technical education graduates are there in our country in the early career, mid careers, and that becomes the backbone for this entire, you know, the dream we have with respect to the Viksit Bharat by 2047, us being a developed nation. It will require this to be done really, really well in the next 5-10 years, how education is built at the technical level in a more robust manner.
From a big picture, how many computational designers and BIM engineers does India need?
As of today, north of 1.5 lakh, 2 lakh. Like, to
and
give
how
you an
many
idea,
are being produced through the traditional university system?
So see, BIM is a new technology. I'll give you a quick data. Number of civil, mechanical, electrical, electronic engineers together and architects all together, they are like close to, almost 12 to 13 lakhs being added every year. And then there is further IT and computer science, which eventually goes to a number of 18, 20 lakhs of technical education enrollments every year. And eventually, 5-7 lakh people move into IT, and probably a bit more into IT and different fields like finance or HR or MBA and all these spaces. But the remaining like 10 odd lakh people, they want to move into either manufacturing segment, which is also automobile, industrial design, industrial, engineering, all that, and architecture, construction, and engineering coming together. And these both have close to 4-5 lakh people moving into both these fields. And overall, if you look at it, the country does employ close to 1.5, 1.8 crore civil engineering, electrical engineering, all these professionals coming together. There is going to be a point 10 years from now where everyone would need to know BIM, else they will be redundant in the industry. The way 20, 25 years back, CAD took over, like computer-aided design had to be thing. From hand drafting, everyone need to know CAD, software is being AutoCAD and others related to it. And that transition happened for 10, 12 years. This is the time for BIM to take up in the best possible manner.
Amazing, amazing. So there is like a 10, 12 year journey of upskilling everyone in this AEC field.
Yeah, totally.
Amazing. Awesome. So my last question to you, any advice for young aspiring founders?
Okay. I would say stay true to why you started what you started always. Like, that has worked for us. We had a clear goal. We want to make a difference to this particular industry through education in this possible manner. And we went through a lot of ups and downs and a lot of push in general through a variety of things that happened externally, internally, and learning. But just staying true to why you started it always helps you go through the hard times, cherish the good times collectively, and surround yourself. Like, again, this has worked for us, and I think this really, really comes together really well, that get people from your network to work with you. To give you an idea, I graduated from SPA. We are a 200 people organization today. Almost 10 to 12% of our organization is SPA graduates. They are my juniors, seniors, batchmates, all coming together. Let's make this happen. Let's make a difference to the world out there and change the way industry operates. So see if you can, bring that together. And rest all is obviously problem solving and math.